There has been coverage nationally of labor and on Pacifica, and I think one of the best stations to listen to, or one of the best radio programs to listen to, is Counterspin. And we have with us tonight Janine Jackson from New York, and she has been covering, as well as the rest of the producers at Counterspin, some of the stories about labor and the struggle against censorship and the struggle to get labor's voice out. So welcome, Janine Jackson.
Thank you. I'm proud to say I also host a cable access show in New York called Labor at the Crossroads. We're talking this week about the NAB, the National Association of Broadcasters, and one of the things that I've been pointing out that we've been talking about is that they have always promoted, the NAB has since its beginnings promoted this model of broadcasting that we have today, this commercial advertiser-driven model, and they've thwarted alternatives. Now, labor groups and working people lose out in this corporate system, in this model of broadcasting, in a couple of ways that I want to talk about. First of all, you know, this system where media companies are giant corporations and where the revenue that fuels the system comes from other giant corporations who are advertisers. That's the system. This is bad for labor and for working people across the board for a couple of reasons. First of all, very simply, corporate media owners are part of corporate America, and they just don't have an interest, a bottom-line interest, in telling, as Dick was explaining, in telling stories about labor and about labor's battles and struggles for fair wages and working conditions and so on. In fact, media companies are themselves some of the most anti-labor companies around. So, for example, you can have the Washington Post, which has an editorial that says, you know, it's not so bad using replacement workers. We've used them ourselves, you know. It worked out great for us, you know. In fact, a Washington Post reporter named Peter Pearl some years ago decided to do an undercover investigation on these union-busting companies, and he went sort of undercover to a meeting of one of these organizations. And as he's in this room, he's looking around and seeing one boss of his from the Washington Post and another boss. Here are his bosses taking lessons, you know. And in fact, he talked to one of the heads of this company, and he said, oh, yes, the Washington Post is a leader in this field. And then you can also have something like the Detroit Free Press, who editorialized for the ban on replacement workers, but then when their workers went on strike, they immediately went and brought in scabs right away. So don't believe everything you read, I guess, is the lesson there. So that's the first way. Corporate media are corporations. It's just not in their interest to consistently tell stories that substantively undermine their worldview. But then there's another way that this system works badly for labor and for working people, and that's the fact that it's an advertiser-driven system. And this is something that it's hard to remember. It's hard to keep in mind. We hear about the media market, you know, and I think we forget that in this market, we, the audience, are not the client. There is a market of some sort, but the client is the advertiser. We're the product, you know. We're what's being sold. Our attention, our eyeballs, as they call them. And if you read these trade magazines or some of the NAB literature, it's very crude. It's very straight up, you know. Pictures of people tied up and in boxes saying, we deliver Hispanics to you, you know, or something like this, you know. We're the product. Now, what that means is that it really isn't the public that's ultimately determining what gets on the air. It's the ones who sign the checks, and those are the sponsors. And if you don't think people are very aware of their corporate owners, you know, in the news division, maybe they don't even know who their corporate parent is. Well, just think that when Disney had 101 Dalmatians out in the theaters, Peter Jennings of ABC News, his paycheck had spots on it, you know, just like everybody else. Within the company. So it's the sponsor that's determining what kind of programming we're going to get. And sponsors don't want just any old audience. They don't want to have their ads on shows that reach the widest variety of people. They want particular audiences, and they pay a premium for those audiences. What kind of audience? Well, wealthier, higher end, you know, high income. And also, and here's a dirty little secret that's a very open secret, white, you know. They have particular kinds of audiences they want. They pay more for programs that reach those audiences. They pay less for programs that don't. That's the structure of the system. And so they're not really interested in shows about working people's struggles. That's not really reaching the clients that they want to reach. And news is also skewed in this way, as I'm sure you know. So we can have stories like, a cover story on a magazine that says, everyone's getting rich, you know. And you think to yourself, well, I'm not getting rich. Nobody I actually know is getting rich, you know. And yet here this is a National News Weekly saying, this is the story of the day, how everyone's rich nowadays, you know. Well, you know, they're reaching out for the people who they think are going to jibe with that. You know, and Newsweek had a story about, you know, the kind of guilt that you feel when all of a sudden you're richer than your friends. And, you know, how do you talk to them? And it's really kind of, you know, there's a lot of angst there, evidently. I don't know. And you can have straight up anti-union coverage. And this is, I mean, you really can't say this boldly enough. I mean, there aren't too many constituencies left that people can talk about this way, where Time Magazine can begin a story. This was a story about Ron Carey several years ago. Time Magazine begins a story saying, images of union leaders as spaghetti-sucking mob bosses may be harsh. They may also be true. You know, and you love the, like, bit of ambiguity in there, you know. I'm sure that reporter would say, I did not say, will determine whether GM can stick to its gut-wrenching plan to become a lean industrial powerhouse or give in once again to the United Auto Workers Union. Well, you know, which side are you supposed to be on in that conversation? But I love how analysts say, you know, it's not, again, it's not USA Today, it's some unnamed analyst who can be brought in to make that point. And then you also have, and I think Dick told this very vividly, you also have the large-scale abandonment of the labor beat, which used to be, you know, I don't think stories of the halcyon days of media when everyone had I don't think those days existed, but we did used to have a labor beat as a regular feature in many papers. And this is crucial. It was understood that it was different than the business beat, you know? It was understood that labor and that economics is a contested field, that economics is a political field where some people have some interests and they oppose the interests of other groups in society. We don't have that economic coverage nowadays. We have economic news that really, I mean, they might as well say what's good for GM is good for the country. You know, it's implicit in every story that the rising tide is lifting all boats and that we're not talking about something where a gain for management may not be a gain for the workers. It's just, it's all one. We're all just one happy family. And after all, since now people have some bonds maybe, or maybe a little bit in the stock market. Now really, you know, really, now Wall Street's interests really are your interests. So that's there. And then, you know, the labor beat disappearing, that was actually one of the sort of many casualties of the Detroit strike, which not everyone noticed. I mean, we remember all the horrible coverage and the treatment of workers and Robert Giles, the Detroit News editor, writing a column in which he said that management was carrying out the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr., you know, because they were standing up to the established order. Oh, okay. But one of the... is deep, yeah. But one of the casualties of that strike was the labor beat. The Detroit Free Press had a labor reporter. He went out on strike with the strikers, and they just never replaced him. Whoops, you know. That beat's disappeared, and we're talking about Detroit. Okay. So straight-up anti-union coverage that fits in with that. Now, this, of course, extends, as Dick also mentioned, to PBS, to public broadcasting as well, which is supposed to be the alternative. I'm talking about commercial media. This is the commercial media system that's driven by advertisers, and that's why it's skewed in this particular way. You wouldn't think that would be the case with public broadcasting, but unfortunately it is. In fact, activists, including FAIR activists, have regularly been told over the years that PBS would love to have a show about labor. It's just they can't find a corporation that wants to sponsor it. You know. So we have four or five on our public alternative media. We have, depending on your market, we have four or five or more shows about picking stocks and investing. As if that really was what we were all up to, you know. I mean, in case, you know, I know we know in this room the vast majority of people make their living from wages, okay?
What about the PBS guidelines?
Well, exactly. That's, thank you, Henry, you know. So, you know, that's the lay of the land. So the next step might be, well, why don't unions fund a show? That was just what I was getting to. Why don't unions fund a show? Unions have money. Some of them do. Why don't they fund their own show? Well, because PBS has these guidelines that say that the producers of a show can't have too close an interest in the content of the show that they're producing. And these guidelines are interpreted in really, it would twist your brain in a knot to try to follow them the way this works. The way it's played out, well, for example, the documentary Out at Work, which was a documentary that talked about workplace discrimination against gays and lesbians. This was an award-winning documentary that PBS refused to distribute. And when you read, as I've read the letter to the producers explaining why they couldn't distribute it, they said, we have guidelines that prohibit even the appearance of a conflict of interest between the producers and the content of a show. And we know that, and that you got, you know, a $5,000 check from the UAW here, and you got, you know, a couple thousand dollars from another union over here. And even though we know that this didn't influence the content of your show, and by the way, the documentary is wonderful, we love it, but these strict guidelines that we have, our hands are tied, we just can't distribute it. They also said that one of the other problematic funders was a group called Estrella, which is a national lesbian rights organization, which I presume might be seen as biasing the producers in favor of human rights. The thing to know is that PBS, these guidelines are very slippery and bendy and stretchy, such that even in this case where no one union had given the majority of the funding to Out at Work. In fact, the producers had paid it most of it out of their own pocket. And the program was not about any one union in particular. It was about an issue. It could not be read as an advertisement for any union by a long shot. But that was, you know, they have these guidelines, and it's not really real conflict of interest. It's just the appearance of a conflict of interest. Nevertheless, that same network, and I could give many examples, but my favorite is that they aired a documentary called James Reston, The Man Millions Read, that was about a New York Times columnist. And it was directed by a woman who is a Salzburger, a member of the family that owns the Times. And, gee, it was produced by the New York Times. And I actually had the opportunity to have a sort of debate with a representative of PBS about this, just this issue. She talked about Out at Work, and I said, well, what about James Reston, The Man Millions Read? And suddenly, things were different. And it wasn't the appearance of a conflict of interest. She said, but the New York Times didn't fund that. I said, yes, they did, actually, you know, because, see, we looked into it, and they actually did provide the funding. Well, but they produced it in collaboration with a TV station in Virginia, and we didn't really feel that, you know, the New York Times held editorial control. Said, well, do you feel that the UAW held editorial control of Out at Work? You know, the point being they didn't even ask the question with regard to Out at Work. And then when I said, well, that doesn't sound right to me. And everyone in the room groaned, you know, audibly. She said, well, but it's also something else. It's that the New York Times is a journalistic institution, and so we felt they could be expected to handle it fairly and to not have a, you know, blah, 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 blah. The point is, a double standard is no standard at all. And in fact, when pressed on the matter by formerly Village Voice reporter Jim Ledbetter, asking a PBS representative, does this mean that in effect no union can ever fund a show that will air on PBS? He said yes. He said, yeah, that's what it means. And yet corporations can regularly, on a weekly, daily basis, sponsor shows that are about their own interests. So that's, you know, even where we would look to for the change, it's not there for the alternative. So I guess my point is, corporations are never going to want to sponsor shows about poor people, about working class people, about unions, or really about anything that they believe. That's nice. Am I getting a? They're trying to shut us down. You know. They're never going to want to produce or sponsor programs that really substantively undermine their worldview. And so the point is that these problems are structural. It's not that reporters are evil. It's not that reporters are stupid, although heaven knows some are. It's not that they're bad. And it's not, and this is, I really want to emphasize, it's not that labor isn't savvy enough, you know. It's not that unions aren't clever enough about how to get their issues covered. Although many people, I feel, still believe that, that if we could just do it right, if we could just tell the story in a snappy enough way, maybe they'd give us better coverage. The problems are structural in this country, and it does not need to always be this way. What we have to do and what we're trying to do this week is to refocus the whole discussion around media, refocus that whole debate so that the public interest is at the center of it and not an afterthought, not a byproduct, hopefully, perhaps. We have to stop asking whether the system is working for the media companies that run it and start asking whether it's working for people. So that's what we're here about this week, and I'm happy to see so many of you.